This is the Authentic Persuasion Show.
Hey, what's going on, everybody? Welcome to another special guest episode of the Authentic Persuasion Show. Super excited for my guest today. I got Mr. Jay Hammonds of Dial America. He actually grew up in the call center, contact center, customer experience industry. 30 years of going from what started out as a part-time job to where he is now, managing leading call centers, client service teams all around the globe, everywhere you can imagine. He joined Dial America 15 years ago this month, I think it might be longer, and his new business responsibilities parallel his work as a consultant. And of course, you know, a company like Dial America, and with 30 years experience in call centers, you know, I got to have him on the show here to talk about sales, leadership, business. Jay, welcome to the Authentic Persuasion Show.
Thanks, Jason. Really glad to be here. This is awesome.
So one of the things that you put in your intro was that your part-time job got out of hand. What does that mean? When you put that in there, I didn't read that part in the intro because I was just curious. I wanted to ask you about it.
It's a very true story. This was a part-time job that just got way out of hand. I started working for a call center company in Wichita, Kansas, where I responded to a newspaper ad. They were offering $10 an hour in 1988. So that was stupid money. That was ridiculous money. Yeah. I mean, I think $6 an hour, $7 an hour, and you felt like you were rolling high. But they were offering $10 an hour. Pardon me.
Wow.
For a part-time job, that just seemed ridiculous. So I took it. I went in, and because I was stupid and naive, I wore a tie and a suit to this part-time job interview. And I walked in, and they said, "Well, what are you here for?" And I said, "The job that pays $10 an hour. That's what I want." And so they hired me as a rep, and I was a rep on the phone for 2 weeks, I think 3 weeks. And then somebody called me at home and said, "Do you have a tie?" And I said, "Yeah." And they said, "Great, wear it because you're a supervisor now." And I said, "Oh, okay. That's I guess what we're doing." And I loved the call center. It was fantastic. It was the best part-time job, but it just kept spiraling from there. After a few months, they said, "Oh, by the way, we're opening an office here. Would you like to go up and do that?" And then, "Oh, by the way, we're going to expand a day shift here, and can you do that?" And I just kept filling in spots wherever we were going, and I got to see a whole bunch of Kansas and Missouri and Nebraska that I probably never would have seen because of them.
That's awesome. So I see that path a lot for people where they start out, maybe they're not sure what's going to happen, and then it kind of goes up and around, and you know, they turn it into something more. That first one, if you can think back and reflect back, you're there for a couple of weeks, they make you a supervisor, right? They just call you, you have a tie. Now you get to wear that tie that you wore in the beginning. Why do you think that was? Was it something you were doing, or were you just the one who showed up every day and that's what got you to be a supervisor?
No.
What do you think led to that first one?
I think the fact that I demonstrated I was into what we were doing. I wanted to do it. I did well. I enjoyed the job was selling magazine subscriptions on the phone. Okay. And we were selling like Sports Illustrated or something like that. And I was just really good at it. I loved sports. I had subscription to Sports Illustrated ever since I was a little kid, and I just got really into it. I liked talking to people about it. And I guess I'm too gregarious for my own good, I guess. And so I knew most of the people who were working the same shift, and I think they just said, "All right, well, you can do this. Do this."
Yeah, I love it. So, and then, what do you think was like? Or actually, the question I have: when they moved you to supervisor, did they give you training? Did they give you guidance, or did they do what most organizations do and just said, "You're a supervisor now. Do the same thing with everyone else that you're doing"?
That's a great question. I cannot say enough about the guidance and training that I got to become a supervisor. This was back in the late 80s, and I worked for a company that really believed in ongoing education for supervisors, shift managers, center managers. They really invested a lot of time. We had a staff of corporate trainers, and that's all they did was hold additional training classes for supervisors. This was back when budgets were here and training departments were a lot thicker for most companies out there. And it made a huge difference because it got everybody singing from the same book. It got everybody understanding the same goals, the same objectives. You drank the Kool-Aid, and then you were able to go out and execute what the company vision was.
Yeah. That's in your career, because this is an important topic. I want people to hear this and take something from it. In your career that you've had, like let's say prior to Dialmerica or even organizations that you've seen, any idea percentage of companies that feel that same way, that put that same amount of effort into leadership training? I mean, is that rare? Is that common?
It's not as common as it used to be. I think that's one of the areas that unfortunately has been impacted by a lot of budget cuts at a lot of different companies. I think it's one of the differentiating factors for us, frankly, is that we do invest a lot of additional time and training and resources for our teams to make sure that they get additional support at every center. And I think when you invest in people, those investments pay off. And I know for a fact that I owe my entire career to learning as a supervisor at Eidelman Telemarketing in 1989. I mean, that's what set me up. There used to be signs on the wall that would say, openers are a dime a dozen, closers are worth their weight in gold. And that kind of, it stuck with me, and it gave me a path.
Well, and I think the difference is I've seen those kind of posters up at organizations, and they just assume that if they hire the right people and throw them into the environment, that they'll find those closers, right? Instead of grooming them, growing them, supporting them, training, coaching, providing guidance. So I love hearing that. I unfortunately see, and maybe it's just as a consultant and what I come across, a lot of organizations where they don't do that. It's like they do some initial training and then not much ongoing training, and they think that people should just know, or they have too many other fires that they're dealing with and they don't make that a priority. For you, what kind of oversight, are you dealing with now on any sales related campaigns or internal sales? Like, what does that look like for your current experiences?
This is an information now world that we live in. Total transparency, immediacy is really what it's about. So with tools like Salesforce and APIs that can give clients real-time dashboards into how every single KPI they've established is performing, a long time ago, you used to wait until you got your reports in the morning and then you would take action on the previous day, but that's 150 years ago, because now I can take proactive approaches to trends that I'm seeing happen, and I can identify and be much more responsive. In today's universe, if I'm not responsive, I'm old news. Yesterday's newspaper is only good for lining a birdcage. There's nothing else good for it.
Yeah. For these sales campaigns that you're seeing, what would you say is the difference from like what you started with selling magazines to now, as far as how companies have to approach sales, both internally and then dealing with those potential clients they're trying to enroll?
Well, I think. There's a vast difference in some respects between internal and external, and there's also some commonality. And I guess the commonality is that you've got to have the right market. And if you're not in the right market, you're not going to be successful. If you don't have solutions/products that are relevant to that market, you're wasting your time. And you have to know where you're relevant. If you can't participate, if you can't add value, you should not be there.
Makes sense. I see that a lot, where salespeople, companies fall in love with whatever they're selling, and they think the world is just going to want it, right? Field of dreams mode. If I build it, they will come. Versus what does the market want?
Yeah, I think that the field of dreams is maybe the most expensive field that ever gets built, right? Because and I love the notion of anticipating what your clients are going to want to do. That's key. You have to know where things are headed. But to think that you have the blueprint for that field of dreams for your client is kind of ridiculous. I mean, it takes a long time to really get a full understanding of what their field of dreams looks like. Because you may love white picket fences and they may be crazy about chain link. You need to, those details really matter. It's not my dream, it's their dream. So I have to be able to understand exactly what they're doing. I mean, when we talked initially, I think I said to you, I'm not a really good salesperson, but I love solving problems and I like figuring things out, because that's fun. That's a great time and everybody benefits. That's what I want to be part of.
So on that note, because I remember that resonating with me, and I was like, oh, this is going to be a fun conversation, because we're both thinking and approaching it in the same way. what have you found with taking that, right, where you're not so much selling, air quotes, and sales is that dirty word thing that people might think about, but just trying to solve problems and approaching something, and like you're not trying to convince someone to buy from you, you're just trying to find a way to help. How do you do the second step in that process, which is to move them forward, to make sure that they're taking action on that, right? And the language I use is the order takers, which they're trying to solve problems, but then they're just hoping the other person says yes or begs them, right? What have you found as the key to that second phase, which is to actually make the sales happen?
I feel like this is a very simple answer that's really hard to explain. But it really comes down to managing expectations from the very beginning. Expectation management is what it's what my entire job is about. I'm talking to people who are incredibly busy. They have very, very big challenges in front of them, whether it's making budget or they're slightly missing or whatever those challenges are. They've got things that are keeping them up at night. And if I can have a conversation with them about how I may have helped somebody else slay those dragons or help put those creatures to bed, then I become relevant to them. But I'm only as good as what I know. And so I don't really feel like I ever do a whole lot of selling. I do a whole lot of questioning about, well, tell me more about that. The trick is really about getting to that conversation, getting the right person to have that conversation with. But if you know what you're talking about and you're genuine, you tend to find them.
And there's something you said in there is very quick that you went through, which is asking questions and trying to find out about their situation, what they want or need. And then I know that one of the biggest things you told me was the value in listening, which I think we probably both know that a lot of people in sales and in life in general just don't actually listen. Where does that fit in with you and or like for other people who are running sales teams or leaders? Like, how do you encourage, inspire, train, coach that listening, the question asking and then the listening side?
You know, one of my first big failures in sales taught me the value of asking questions and listening. I built a tremendous relationship with a decision maker at a Fortune 5 company and felt like we had kicked it off and we'd had a series of meetings where we would talk about things. We'd talk about the business specifically. And then like on our fifth meeting, I tried to close him. And I said, I need to put some pricing together for you. And he stopped and we were having lunch and I'll never forget this, but my buyer stopped mid-sentence, fork in the air and said, pricing? How can you give me pricing? You don't even know what I want yet. And I've never felt more insignificant or smaller than I did at that moment in time. And I'm sure I came up with something like, well, you've told me this and you've told me that and you've told me that. And he made it abundantly clear that I didn't have the tip of the iceberg as far as information that would be necessary to come up with pricing. So how you coach that is by being accountable to the stakeholders at our organization. I work for our client services teams. Whatever promises I make as a salesperson, that team is accountable and responsible for delivering to. We're all part of the same team. We all have to land that whale, if you will. It takes a village to land a whale. A whale doesn't get caught by a single fisherman. The team has to understand what their expectations are, and the only way they can know that is by getting them from the client. So my job is to make sure I understand what everybody involved needs to be successful.
I think that's amazing. I love the analogy with the whale, and you know, it just takes a group of people, right? It's not just one person that's going to be able to do that. And of course, a lot of people in sales just are setting things up for their own benefit or for their own reasons, and then making it somebody else's mess to deal with on the client services, operations, processing, fulfillment. Did you end up getting that deal with the Fortune 5?
No, guy? No. I did not get that deal because the window fell apart. That conversation basically told us that we weren't there. And it also told my client, more importantly, that I was too eager. I was trying to create a solution for a problem I did not understand. And that was the lesson that I took away from that. You did not know what you were trying to do. And when it finally came out that this is exactly what needs to be done, I couldn't have done it anyway. In the situation I was in, the company couldn't provide the services he was looking for. But for some reason, in my hubris, I thought maybe I had a shot.
Right. And that goes back to kind of what I was mentioning, where salespeople just, they fall in love with what they're selling, and they think that everyone wants it, and they just assume that you should want this thing. And it's like, wait, does everybody? Would it be valuable? Does it help? Right? And that's where the questions and the listening come in. When we're talking about the leadership side, because you have a ton of experience, obviously, from what, 2-3 weeks in, then you went into a supervisor role and you're managing and leading things for a while. What's one of the biggest challenges that, you see or face with scaling up sales teams, call centers, things like that?
That's a great question. Finding people who really want to be salespeople, finding people who really want to be that person, who want to be able to listen and take no and move on to the next and take no and move on to the next until they find that they're relevant. People who want to be in it so that they can solve problems and not just make a buck. Because honestly, you're going to be disappointed. One bad week, one bad quarter, you're out, you're done. It's over. You need to be able to focus on a much longer game. You need to find your satisfaction in being able to contribute some value someplace, because when you do that, good things happen for everybody, always. And finding people who want to do that and take a real consultative approach in our industry is tough. You have to know what you're selling, and you have to, and more importantly, you have to know what your marketplace is looking for and how what you're selling is relevant in that marketplace.
Yeah, I think that's so important. So how much of that is hired for? How much of that is taught and trained and conditioned in your experience?
Man, I've worked with a lot of different sales teams over my career. And I will tell you that most of the time once you're at the director or VP level of sales, they're expecting people to come in with a Rolodex and their own training, whatever that might be. And paying a certain amount of money to get that sort of training. And I don't see a lot of companies that go on and further invest in that additional retraining. I'm very lucky in that Dial has invested in us over and over again. Tim Searcy was a legend in our industry, and that's where we got that whole whale analogy. I mean, that was part of the Dial America culture that came directly from him. And that was by direct virtue of a 3-day sales intensive that we hired Tim to come out and do for our company. And again, what was the purpose of that? To get everybody singing from the same book, to understand the company value proposition and us out there delivering the way we should. We've done things with Charles Bernard, who's another fantastic sales coach. He did a 3 or 4 day intensive with us. I think he's done 2 or 3 with us so far. The company has invested in us, and we're a very small sales team. There are 3 of us for Dial America that sell, and each one of us has been in this industry for probably 25 or 30 years. Drew Allen and I have known each other since 1990 or something like that. And through our various travels, he's now at Dial America, and John Redinger has been there for like 37 something years or something like that. And we're very lucky to work in a collegial environment. He treats us very much like peers because of the experience level that we have and because of what we know. He's a great servant leader. I mean, and that's the model that we need to have as salespeople. We have to be servant leaders, because if you're not serving anybody, you're not getting anything.
Yeah, and I talk about all the time where sales is service, right? And being a good salesperson and a sales professional is actually being a leader of the prospect and the conversation and the process and being the guide and the leader that they want to follow. So I love hearing you combine those two, which is the servant leadership model and mindset to do that. For what you've seen with call centers, sales teams, right? You obviously have a small one, but what you've seen out there, what are the biggest challenges that you've either faced or seen companies, organizations, teams deal with when shifting from kind of that growth mode where it's like, get a bunch of people and just hope that they know what to do, into, all right, now we need systems, we need processes, we need structure in place. Like, we need to make this official and stop playing around at sales and like build a operation.
You know, I think that's a big question. So I'm going to break it into a couple of little pieces. But I feel like the biggest thing that companies go through is the adoption of those systems and the discipline that it really takes to get everybody on the same page again. I feel like I've said same page over and over again. Consistency is everything. If you don't have consistency, again, you're just firing off wildly into the sky. You have to have a target, you have to know what you're shooting at, and you have to be able to measure the results of what you've been shooting at. So what I see, what we do quite a few sales campaigns with our clients, KPIs across the board. And those same KPIs that we use to manage agents in call centers around how many calls did you make? What was your conversion rate? What was your average handle time? These same metrics apply a lot to the business that we're doing. How many new conversations did I have this week? Because I know I need to have 10 new conversations this week in order to have two conversations next week that might lead to a deal 2 months from now. Yeah. And I skipped like 15 steps in that whole thing, but the whole metric, you know, I know I need to have 10 conversations every single week if I want to deliver on my number.
Well, and you can't control results, right? You can only control actions and activities. And so you've got to do that. And then you've got to measure it. You got to make sure you're doing it. I know one of the things you had mentioned to me too was that discipline around creating the systems. And you had said something which was very interesting and really, I'd never heard it before. And it really rocked me mentally. I'm like, this is the message where you said you don't have to want the system. You have to learn to need it.
You have to become an addict. You have to need it. It doesn't matter whether you like it. Doesn't matter whether you don't like it. What matters is it's happening. This is a thing that is happening now, and you need to. There was an old boss I had one time that said, "You can either get on the bus or you can get run over by the bus." And it's this progress is nonstop. It's going to happen. Get on the bus. It's a much better view.
How? Any tips or things that you've learned in your career on helping people embrace that constant change? Or is that something hiring the right people, setting the right expectation, and making sure they're willing to stay on the bus and not get run over?
Flexibility is everything. Flexibility is everything. And in our role at this point, you've demonstrated some flexibility probably to get here, and hopefully you can continue to demonstrate that same flexibility because the environment is changing. Demands are changing. I mean, just think about COVID 2 years ago. I spent, I don't know, 30 weeks on a plane probably pre-COVID, and then all of a sudden I didn't. But suddenly I had 30 Zoom meetings a week. That's better. That's actually better than going on the plane for, you know what I mean? There's a big difference there. I'm not going to complain about that change in process. I don't mind living in airports. It's okay.
Yeah. But is, you know, a sales team, the people in an organization, right? The people in a call center, let's say, are they embracing that change, new systems, new processes when things have to pivot? Is there anything that an organization can do to improve the ability for the team to accept that change, or for salespeople listening to this that are like, I don't like change and I don't like when they mix things up, like, you know, something that can help.
You know, I
that?
Feel like I've seen that and I've experienced that too. And I think I'm thinking back to my call center days and the call center environment when I ran call centers, when I was growing up in call centers, there change is something that's just part of every single day. You don't know what's going to happen today until you get into the office, and then maybe you're calling that same program, or maybe you're calling a different program. And this was, you know, things changed. It happened. You had to be quick to pivot, and you identified who was quick to pivot. And typically those people rise up the ranks and become leaders because they're flexible and they're nimble and agile. That's the most important aspect, right? That lack of being able to pivot quickly typically comes from a lack of confidence, doesn't it? I mean, if you don't have confidence, it's really tough to move forward boldly. So getting some additional education, taking a couple of minutes to watch a couple of YouTube videos. TikTok videos can teach you things that you never even considered, but just invest a little bit of time to build your confidence in that subject, and you'll find that that confidence grows, particularly if you have the discipline to do it.
It makes sense. It's fascinating because I've read some books about that where, you know, part of it will mention the confidence piece, right? So when you have the confidence, you're willing to take risks because you trust in yourself that you know you can manage it, handle it, overcome challenges, or just deal with whatever might come at you because you have some basic skills. So it's interesting hearing you talk about that in handling change from an employee standpoint. And then as a leader, what I'm thinking when I hear you say is that companies do what you can to build up the confidence, which is that training, the coaching, the leadership, the internal resources, so that the team feels more confident to boldly go where, you know, who knows where it's going to go this week or this month. And I think that's valuable because I saw the same thing with a lot of companies during COVID in the beginning, where everyone had to pivot. People are now working from home. The ones that did it well because they had an organization centered around that, and the ones that just completely fell apart, which I'm sure you saw.
We saw the same thing. We've experienced some of the same things. I mean, it was a brand new world for everybody. So there was a lot of learning there. I think we crammed 5 or 6 years of learning into about 8 months. For one of our clients, we were joking. We closed a really big project with a client right as COVID started, and we had 1,500 agents on the phone within about 3 weeks after one phone call with somebody who said, okay, let's make this happen. And then we built a plane as we were flying it. Systems integration, you know, those types of things. Agility is really what it comes down to. I didn't sell that so much as I arranged a team of subject matter experts to interface with another team of subject matter experts and actually get down to work. And if there's one thing that I have learned in this entire industry, whether you're at the rep level or you're at our level, the sooner you get down to work, the better. I'm not here to do anything but solve problems and eat bologna sandwiches. We're out of bologna sandwiches.
I love it. I think that's amazing. And I think that's a great place to stop because I think that's some good advice for this part. Obviously, we'll continue chatting in the after show part two. So I know for people who might want to hear more, talk to you about Dial America, check out that or just connect with you, like we've done on LinkedIn. So dialamerica.com is a great place for people to go. And all this will be in the show notes. Jay Hammons, which is HAMMANS. At dialamerica.com is a good email. And then also they can find you, Jay Hammons, on LinkedIn, which is always fun. And that's where we connected. And I appreciate you being here. I think this is fun hearing from somebody who fell into a call center, a part-time job, had no idea, wasn't planning on it longer term other than this is a great paying job, and then seeing where you've taken it and what you're doing now. And I appreciate all the stuff that you shared. And for you,
thanks so much. Thanks so much for having me. I hope this was good for you. I really enjoyed our conversation.
Yeah. And for everyone tuning in, I appreciate you being a part of this journey and goal to shift sales from being a dirty word to something the world actually trusts and respects. The things that Jay and I were just talking about with sales as service and servant leadership. And then while helping you close more deals and make more money. So until next time, thanks for helping fill the world with authentic persuaders. And Jay and I will see you in part two. Make sure to check that out for the after show conversation.